We love our children. We protect them. We guide them. We prepare them for life in the world. With all that we do, from deep in our hearts, we cannot control all things. Life-threatening illnesses and disabilities affect far too many of our children each year. While we cannot change the circumstance, we can make dreams come true. Dreams to provide hope, to provide spiritual healing and strength, to provide moments of happiness and relief in the hardest of times. We can give a glimmer of light and hope in a time of darkness and despair. Join huntofalifetime.org to help make dreams come true, to provide hope for children with life-threatening illnesses and disabilities. Hunt of a Lifetime is a nonprofit organization fulfilling dreams for hunting and fishing trips to youth 21 and under with life-threatening illnesses and disabilities. Visit huntofalifetime.org to learn how you can make a difference.
Please join me, Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and other Game Wardens on our adventures, protecting wildlife, saving lives, and having fun, all while serving the public and the natural resources of our planet. Listen to the tales and experiences of those who work in the outdoors while being entertained with stories about encounters with poachers, wildlife investigation, murder investigation, near-death experiences, search and rescue missions, wildlife interactions from game wardens around the country and around the world. When I retired, I realized I couldn't let go of that legacy, but rather wanted to share the passion, the commitment, and the stories of those men and women that call themselves game wardens. This is Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and this is Warden's Watch.
Warden's Watch, episode 99, with Susan Swim of Missouri. And it's DNR, right, Susan?
No, it's Missouri Department of Conservation.
See, and I, every state is a little bit different, and I usually, before I do a podcast, I always try to look ahead, and I didn't look ahead, and I would say the majority of DNR, so I went with that, and then I failed.
No, that's fine.
Thanks for joining us, and we have done a kind of a little series here with Brock Hoyt, winning the Torch Award, being one of the youngest game wardens I think I've had on the show, to Bob Bashaw, retired, who is 87, I believe, at this point. And then, Susan, you're kind of in the middle, and when I talk to you, and this is our second recording, unfortunately, folks, because I had some technical difficulties. Every now and then that happens. But what resonated off of you, Susan, is when we spoke, is that you got revitalized when you got a canine. And I think, as game wardens, we all, everybody in a job sometimes hits that dead end, and it's good to change things up. It's good to go on a special team, get promoted. And I think it's like, for me, it was like at that 10-year mark, I was like, you know, I needed something different, a little bit of job change. And we're able to do that in our careers. And that's what resonated off of you for me was, you know, Susan got revitalized when she got this canine and she got all hyped up again and she was back in the game. And that's exciting.
Yeah. Yeah, Missouri, it's an exciting time right now here. We just started the canine program. When I talked to you, we'd only been into it about a year or so. So it's been almost 2 years now. We graduated in May, this last May, for a year with five canines. And I got lucky to get picked to be one of the canine handlers for Missouri. We went through an interview process and went through the whole thing, went to Indiana and went to training and got to take my canine there and went through a brutal boot camp type training. For my age, it was quite the experience having to go through that again, not as young and energetic as some of the young guys and stuff that went through it. So
yeah, but it fired you up, didn't it?
It did. And luckily we've had it. It's been successful. We have we've actually got approved and we've got four more new handlers coming in. And they'll be taking off in February, and they're going to do their canine training in Ohio. Okay. So we're going to have four more to help us out with training and stuff. And it's been a real success here in Missouri. We've had a lot of good cases made and a tremendous amount of PR that we've gotten from it. So it's been a win-win all the way around.
How many officers or agents you're called in Missouri, correct?
Yeah, conservation agents. Boy, you'd ask me that. We have pretty much one per county. I don't have the specific number.
So if you have to guess, and I always guess at our state too, because it's constant changing. But are you over 100?
Oh, yes. Yeah. But we've lost a lot because we have a lot of retirements going on right now. So it's hard to get careers it's been a challenge being able to get people to apply. We do get people to apply, but not as many as we used to. In the past, some of our classes, applications we might get 300, and now we're lucky if we get, 100 sometimes. Mm. But we've got another class coming up here this spring. We just got a class that graduated with 20-some in it, and we're expecting to have another 20 come through, hopefully, this spring. So
I think we're all experiencing that as well. And this generation, they're not looking at careers anymore. They're looking at jobs specifically. And I keep, when I do the research, the average, this generation changes jobs about every 5 years right now. And I want to tell them, if you take a job as a conservation, it's like changing a job all the time because the weather changes. So you get into different things, don't you, Susan?
Oh, exactly. Like about the time you get tired of this cold winter weather, then the fishing season picks up and your whole work habits and everything change. I'm lucky I'm here on a lake assignment. So right now we have archery season going on, waterfowl season. But once that gets through in March, we'll start picking up fishing. But really right now the fishing's already starting. We've got a little bit of nice weather and we get more people out and stuff. And then March 1st, our trout park's open. So it changes all the time. And if you don't like an area, you can always put in and change and move to a different county if you want, if that someplace else comes open. And in Missouri, we have such a vast different community or different state that, if you're up north, you're working farmland. If you're in the Ozark region, you could go work the current river and some of our national rivers, where if you're down here, you could work, some of the Ozark hills and a little bit of both on it. So you never know, change your job and change your area and even change the aspect of your job.
Yeah, and I think that's what I want to push as an educator, as a recruiter for, conservation law programs through my college and stuff. I understand you guys want to change jobs, you want new challenges, but that's what the job as a conservation officer, game warden does constantly. And even these special teams, I'm not sure how many special teams Missouri has, but within our small state, we have probably a half a dozen special teams that you can get on that you can change up your whole scenario, your whole life. Now you're training to be on the dive team. Now you're training with the canines like you did.
Yep.
So, and you were at that point where you were thinking about retirement, weren't you? And then jumped into the canine thing.
I joke with people, I say that, I was going to probably retire this June, but they gave me a dog and a new truck, so I decided to hang around, and it has been well worth it. It'll be a good way to go out when I do retire. It's been a lot of fun, and it's been challenging, but it's also been a lot of fun and meeting interesting people and getting to assist other officers and even other divisions somewhat in our department. So it's been a lot of fun and a big challenge. But
yeah, and you're making all these other officers, all these other divisions believe in the canine program, aren't you?
I hope so. That's the goal.
Every time you have a success, as an officer that's worked with canines throughout my career, always call the canine, because the man hours certainly decrease when we find that evidence. We can spend, 3 days looking for shell casings, and that canine can spend 3 minutes.
Yep.
So
absolutely.
As our numbers reduce, certainly we have to increase our productivity, and I think canines do that for us. But on the other end, there's a lot of training that goes into it. There's a lot of time. There's a lot of commitment, a lot of personal commitment, I'm sure.
Yeah, I thought that once I graduated, I'd just come home with the dog and be able to start working and helping everybody out. But realistically, you're always keeping that dog. You're always having to train constantly all the time with the dog. It's kind of like if you ride a bike. If you quit riding a bike, you become rusty at it and you can't, you're going to have an accident. But it's like the dog. You have to constantly keep practicing and doing those trainings over and over again. to make it successful, to be successful.
So you're doing probably training almost daily on somewhat of levels.
Yeah, pretty much. You try to do something every day. Even if I'm driving around working and I'll throw an article out or hide something and then come back later on after my shift and go have the dog deploy on it to look for it. So you're always doing little things, and it may just be 5-10 minutes, but it helps in the long run to keep doing that over and over again.
Hmm. And how many years do you have in Susan?
Starting this month, it'll be 34 years. So, and I've been in the same county for 34 years, so I was needing a little bit of a change. So,
that's incredible. Can you talk about, I mean, we're going back 34 years as a woman getting into the conservation agent. I mean, you had to be on the cutting edge at that point. You know, because I think going back, we didn't have a woman in New Hampshire 34 years ago.
Yeah. When I started, there were two women that were working, and I know we had some before that, but there were two actually on. And my big fear, I know when I put in for it, I went to one of those college career days, and my dad, one of his friends, was a conservation officer. And so I'd hear his stories, and I wanted to do that. That was my goal. And I listened to him talk about all the things he did and stuff. So it really excited me when I was in college. I worked towards it. But I remember going to a career day, and one of the guys told me, he said, well, if you're a woman and you go to work, you'll be working in Kansas City or St. Louis because they won't put you in a rural area. And I mean, that was 34 years ago. And I'm so glad that, you know, you just hear rumors and stuff. But I think being a woman too, sometimes it's easier for me than some of the guys, because I don't know how to put it. It just seems like sometimes it's easier for me to talk to guys about like, I don't have that ego that gets involved or anything. I know that I'm already, you have to use your voice and your speak to people to get your point across and stuff. So if somebody's upset, it seems easier sometimes, I think.
When you first started, were there ever those sportsmen that talked down to you or?
Oh, I got a nickname here at Susie because the old guy said, I don't know, something about Susie Chapstick, the skier, but. And that was like when I was growing up, if they called me Susie, that was like not, but I just, yeah, it was more the older gentlemen that had trouble. They'd always look at the guy and say, now tell me what, and it may be a young guy that I had that was a field training officer that was with me, but they didn't really know if I knew what I was talking about or trust what I was saying. I can tell you in 34 years, I wish I would have known what I know now then, because it's so much easier now. It's a lot easier to work and visit with people, and maybe you earn the respect or gain it, or maybe it's just all the wrinkles they decide, you know, she must know what she's talking about.
Yeah, no, I think we've all changed too. I remember when I started, and this is a horrible story that I'm going to tell. As a park ranger, I had a female supervisor, and one day this guy reamed Regina. And I went after him and I said, that's no way to speak to a lady. And I gave him the lady talk. And
yeah.
I got reamed harder after that than I ever have before. And it's just because the way I was raised is that was no talk to a lady. Yeah. I saw Regina as a lady. And even though she was my boss and she was in uniform, and boy, I'll tell you what, I'm glad I learned that at the beginning of my career. Because then I just respected, you know, I had several female supervisors after Regina, but Regina was probably the best one. Yeah, it taught me a lot of those skill sets that, you're an officer, and to be treated as an officer and to see you as an equal. And not that I didn't, but just you have to take the way that you grew up sometimes and transform your mind into what it properly is. And I know Regina didn't take it personally, but she was a park ranger, law enforcement park ranger, and that's the way she was to be treated. If they were going to give her a bunch of guff, that's she wanted to take it.
Yeah. I know I had a situation below one of our bridges one day, and I had a couple that I remember this story because they were giving me a rash, and it was a fishing without a permit, something real simple. And they were just giving me all kinds of trouble. And it was during our white bass season, so there was other people standing around watching. And these two older gentlemen that probably gave me trouble and called me Susie came up and they're like, do you need any help? And they're like, we can mess with you, but you're our game warden. We can mess with you. They can't, they're not local. They can't mess with you. If you need anything, we'll help you. So it's kind of, it's a double-edged sword. You know, sometimes those things work out.
Yeah, that's a great little story that they had your back. You're our game warden. If they're going to mess with you, we can call you Sizzy, but they can't.
Yeah.
Oh, yep, I love that. Much. Any other interactions like that because of being a female that you felt uncomfortable at times, or?
There's always. I mean, I'm sure just like with a male officer, there's times that you just know that there's something not right.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as like a lot of times I have a really good support system with my sheriff's department here. So there'd be times I'd have a situation like that and I'm like, hey, I can deal with it here and we can be friendly, or, you know, I can call a couple of my Polk County deputies and they'd be happy to come and waller around on the ground with you or whatever you want to do. And it usually diffuses the situation, but it's that way. And it's changed a lot. Like you were saying, between 30 years ago, it's totally different than what it used to be.
Right. It's not unusual to see a female officer.
No.
Although I think it still is extremely low. It's and I want to say maybe 10% of a field force or less when you look at it. I mean, New Hampshire, we have like 38 field officers and one female.
Yeah.
But if you start looking at the ratios nationwide, even though that seems like crazy, but if you start looking at the numbers and the ratios, that's about the right ratio.
Yeah. I wish I would have got the numbers before we talked, but because I know ours is really high. We just had two new females come in near me, and I've already got, we have a lieutenant that promoted, a female in the county that joins me, and then they filled that position with another female, and then the county to her, Christian County, got filled with a female. So in my area, in my region, there's 3 or 4 female officers and one lieutenant that's a female. So it's getting, I mean, we have quite a few here compared. I mean, not every region's like that, but I'm next to Springfield, Missouri. So that's a big metropolitan area for Missouri. It's not huge, but it draws a lot more people in.
Yeah.
Everybody wants to go to that area.
Maybe you don't know this, but of those females that are getting hired, are they coming from hunting and fishing families? Because I know several that grew up with a dad that hunts and fishes and is very outdoorsy, and they are too, and extremely capable girls. And those are the types that I see as game wardens that are so capable. And yeah, they've killed deer, they've hunted, and you know, you don't want to tell them you can't do something because you'll end up on the ground.
Yep. Some of them are that way. We have some that are learning, you know, like when I started, I was not a big hunter. I rabbit hunted with my uncle, but my dad never really hunted. We were big fishermen. We fished a lot. And over the years, I remember sitting down with one of our lady officers, talking to her and saying, man, it's easy to write fishing tickets. You know, I can you just go up, check them and measure their fish, they're short or not. But the hunting tickets, I just haven't figured that out. And she said, it'll come to you. Just keep doing it longer. And sure enough, after a while, you figure it out. You start listening. You have to listen and to learn. And it took time. But we do have some that just say, we have one that started that her dad worked as a biologist for us, and she's doing super good. So we have some really good ones. So we've been fortunate.
Yeah. Well, I love the fishing side because I don't talk about that as much. But you talked about, checking some crappie fishermen. And that's... I love to eat crappie, and I don't fish them enough because I'm too far north, and they're a little further south of me. But just growing up and knowing those techniques, it's the same with hunting or any outdoor thing, is knowing those techniques, knowing how the poachers operate, where they stick their over limits, where they do that. I'm sure that's helped you out with fishermen.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So. And you're a crappie fisherman yourself?
Oh, I love to crappie fish.
Yeah.
I said I would retire whenever I learned how to use a crappie jig instead of minnows. Because my retirement, I probably couldn't afford to buy minnows all the time.
So
I was getting pretty close to it, and then they gave me the dog and the truck. So then it's like, well,
I have
to figure out something else.
So when you crappie fish, I've always just jigged them. You actually use live minnows?
I used to.
Yeah.
If you don't really know what you're doing, you use the live minnows. This might get me in trouble, but then after time, you learned how to use the the jig and figure out, takes that sensitive rod to that fishing rod. And it is a technique. We have these guys that go out and within 2 hours they'll have their limit. And then you have the people that go out that fish 2 days and get three fish. You know, they're not. So
that's me. 2 days, three fish. That's why I was interested in the minnow idea. Do you have a limit on crappie in Missouri?
We have, it depends on where you're at, but yeah. On the lake I'm at, we have like a 10-inch length limit and then 15 crappie a day. So.
Oh, wow. Interesting. Yeah. Nope, that's good. And we put limits on our panfish too. It was because it started becoming a commercialization of our fish. So, you know, we had to put limits of 25 on panfish basically, no matter what it is, per day, because we had some guys coming from other states that were commercially fishing them and then bringing them back to their states and commercially selling them where they could legally do that. Certainly, when you start doing that on a regular basis, that start decimating any, you know, population of fish. And through the years, we've actually made some really good fishing cases that were related to commercialization. But I'm sure crappie is a serious recreational thing in Missouri. Any other things in Missouri, like paddlefish? And
actually, the paddlefish is a big deal. We've had some big arrests, and we have like a special investigation unit that has worked it and made some really big arrests on the paddlefish. And that's one of the things with the dog that Astro, I want to introduce him to paddlefish eggs and get him trained on detection work on the paddlefish eggs. Probably start that in January, but in March our snagging season opens, and we have a lot of people that travel in from out of state, and there's a lot of commercialization on the paddlefish eggs itself. So,
can we talk a little bit about paddlefish? Because I know nothing about paddlefish. Are they migratory, or are they just in your lakes or in your streams?
No, they're in our lakes, but they will, during certain times of the year, they go up the river some. But we have hatcheries that we stock a bunch of them in.
Okay.
So it's a hatchery thing. And I'm not sure if they reproduce at all in the lakes at all. It's more of a hatchery.
Okay. And their eggs, when you speak of that, that's like caviar, isn't it?
Yes.
That's
what we have the big, that's why they're commercialized. That's why people try to get them. Not everybody, but some will try to just get the fish just for the eggs.
So you can legally catch a paddlefish and eat its eggs. You just can't commercially catch a paddlefish and sell its eggs.
Right. Well, and you can't possess the eggs outside the carcass of the fish. Once you get to your house, you can, but we've made it more regulations. It's just like anything that we've stricken the regulations just to, you know, not everybody's doing that and doing it to do something bad, but or commercialize them, but you have an extreme number of them that are doing it, then you have to change the rules.
You have to close the loopholes that they're using to illegally use your natural resources. Yeah, for sure. Yep. So that'll be something interesting, the dog, to find the paddlefish eggs.
Hopefully. We're hoping that works. We'd also talked about using them in airports and stuff like that, but we haven't gotten that far yet. Mm-hmm. I know some states use them for other things, but for airports and security and stuff like that. But we haven't got to do that too much.
So that's probably a regular issue you deal with is the paddle. If you've got, you know, you're going to train your dogs on that, you had a special unit on it. That's something Missouri is focusing on, is the paddlefish.
It depends. It's just the seasonal thing.
Okay.
Just like it starts in March. We have a lot of people come in. We'd had where the department had rented a bait shop on the lake, and we had a lot of help from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, staffed it with department employees from this unit, the Special Investigation Unit, and they worked it, and they were actually going in recording guys trying to sell the eggs and buying eggs, and it was quite the deal. I think that, I can't remember, they had like a search warrant, and served like over 300 warrants all at the same time, and I got to get involved in that, where we went to a house and knocked on the door, and everybody knocked on the door at the same time. And I don't know exactly how many arrests that came out of it, but, you know, it was a big deal, and it made the National Geographic Award. So, it
wow.
was a big deal. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I find that stuff fascinating because I don't have anything like it. And I just, I want to learn. And all these natural resources that people benefit from, sometimes legally and sometimes not so legally, for sure. And have you had paddlefish eggs before?
Have I what?
Have you ever ate them?
Oh, no.
No.
I think I did once. I went to Nauwia in New York, and I don't know if you were at that one, but they had the caviar, and I think I just tried like a little bit of it. And
yeah.
It was nothing I would want to eat.
I've tried caviar out of the can before, so I don't know what that was from, but yeah, not my taste, salty little,
yeah,
so it wasn't, I don't know the big deal, but.
Yeah, no, I don't either.
So yeah, my grandmother was big on perch eggs, so we'd take all the eggs out of the yellow perch, and she would eat those. Yeah, but I think it was, you know, the things they used to do at the turn of the century, because they didn't have a lot of food. I mean, she'd take bacon fat and put it on bread and eat it, because that's what they did growing up as a little girl, is that's, they didn't have much, so they'd take the bacon fat or the fat and just spread it on that. And so I'm wondering if that was, you know, a derivative of that. Is that what we used to eat? So, but yeah. She would, we'd save all the perch eggs for her, and she would eat those up, and she was all happy to have them. So, certainly a form of caviar, just a different type of fish. Very always interested. So, and your canine. So, you went to Indiana with Jeff Milner, who just retired. That's an awesome program there. You guys now have what? How many dogs did you train in Indiana?
We had 5 that went through Indiana.
And
we had three labs and 2 German Shorthairs.
Nice.
And we went there and graduated, and we're back now. But it was a fun time. The running 1 mile every Friday wasn't so much fun sometimes, but we made it through it. So
yeah, and those tracks, it's just getting in shape to do those tracks, because those tracks can be mile long, 2 mile long. Yep. Just depends on what it is. So, but I get it. At the end of my career, I wouldn't be looking forward to riding a mile every week. I'm certainly glad I promoted.
Yeah, running a mile and running a mile behind a dog that's tracking is a little.
It's a little different, isn't it?
You're being drugged. So I was being drugged a lot at the beginning. So.
Oh, I had a German Shepherd that I trained to track, and what I learned about German Shepherds is they like, you know, the track layer would go through the nastiest stuff, so I'd have to go through that. And it was never slow. It was always fast. And I don't know how many cuts and brambles I would get. And he got the biggest kick out of the guy that was laying the track. He just used to love that. So it was more about dragging me through the woods than it was the dog tracking, because he knew the dog was going to track. Oh, but just
it's gotten a lot easier since I've gotten back. I've slowed him down a little bit, and it's become a lot easier. He's kind of, we got a, you know, more of a on each other's page now. He knows that I'm not going to go as fast as he wants to go, so he has to slow down just a tad bit for me. So
nice. And he's trained on, he's tracking, and what other things is he trained on?
He does, tracking is a big thing. It's been a lot of fun, because we get to track in on, like, if somebody's trespassing, you can tell right away where they went. It's just made so, that saves so much time.
It does.
Not having to sit there for 3 hours waiting for them to come out, and then they come out on the neighbor's property instead. Mm-hmm. But the main thing is probably the evidence or article searches, like the shell casings that we were talking about. Finding shell casings, it's like that gunpowder, finding firearms, it's like crack cocaine to that dog. I mean, it's just phenomenal, the gunpowder smell to them. They find a lot of shell casings. Or if somebody drops something, during deer season, one of the officers contacted me, and actually he's going to be a new canine handler, and he had a gentleman that shot from the roadway, and we went and looked for a shell casing, and we didn't find anything, so we went out in the field to see if the gentleman had gotten a deer, because we had a really good call on it. And we're coming back through, and all of a sudden Astro just like locks up and he lurks on something. Sometimes he sets and sometimes he points, and I hate to get onto him for the pointing, because it's kind of fun to see that point of a Labrador.
Yeah.
So, but he locked up on something. We look down and I go, who lost their keys? And we found that the other officer dropped his keys on his way out. So found the keys.
Made him a believer.
In. Yeah. Well, he was there. He's actually excited about it and put in for the unit and got hired, so he's gonna be got picked to be one of the new canine handlers, so he's excited to get his dog and start.
That's awesome. And again, you're gonna stick with labs and pointers, or
any hunting breed?
Yeah,
op-eared hunting breed. I'd know for sure what they're looking at, the pointers and ones we've got now, but that's not to say they may not go to something else. They may
Yeah, so. no, for sure. And it's interesting to see the pointing breeds coming into that, because that's fairly new, I would say, in the last 10 years that we're actually using those breeds more consistently. And actually, I have two of them in the house now. I was a German Shepherd guy. My son seems to be a German wire hair pointer and a German short hair pointer. We have a little puppy running around the house right now. So
yeah, we won't go to the pointy eared dogs. We'll just do the cunning breed dogs, like
the floppy eared dogs, as Jeff likes to call them.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of interesting the way they work too, the difference between them and the labs, because they cover a whole lot more ground than the labs do quicker. They'll spread out quicker. But then the labs, if you have an area that you want to concentrate, they'll lurk. They don't get too far out, not as far out as like the German short hairs do. So.
And would you say the labs are a little more thorough?
I don't want to get myself in trouble by saying that.
And you're probably a little biased. Yes, I was going to say you're probably a little bit biased there. And I totally 100% understand the bias.
I would get myself in so much trouble if I answered that question.
Yeah, so. No, I get it. And I, as a connoisseur of all breeds, working with 4-H and stuff, everybody has their strengths and their weaknesses. And
yes,
that's
exactly.
One thing I see in the pointing breeds. They are so fast that sometimes they and it's funny because when they go past it and that, all of a sudden they smell it and that head turn and the ring, you know, spin.
Yeah.
And I'm going to relate this because I just came out of New York City. And if you go with a law enforcement officer now around the cities of the country, is when you smell marijuana anywhere now, because it can be anywhere. And it's got that head swivel, the officer gets birdie, I should say.
Yep.
And it's just so funny to, even though it's being legalized everywhere, we have been so in tune to that smell. And it's just like a head pivot. And I just, every time I think of it, I think of it as a dog getting birdie or locking on some evidence there, because that's exactly what that officer has been trained to do for, you know, the guys I'm hanging out with, you know, 20 plus years. And, you know, this next generation of officer is going to be totally different, because they're growing up with a different set of rules.
Yeah, exactly.
Has that been challenging? I mean, you got your tenure in there for sure. Is all the changes that have been coming from law enforcement, especially in the last 5 or 6 years?
It's just, I think back, and I mean, I remember whenever you could just get away from work. You had an answering machine at home that, you know, you get home, check your messages. Now you have that cell phone with you all the time. So even if you're off, you know, I can't stand it. If I'm off and somebody, they have a real problem, they'll call me 5 times, just one right after another, and then you answer and you're off and you answer and it's like, well, there's a deer caught in a fence over here, you know, and it's like something that's like, you know, but it, that has changed a lot because you're more accessible than in the past. As far as the things, as far as rules and regulations, not so much. I mean, you know, in my area, we just legalized marijuana in Missouri. It's going to be legal now, and so it'll be a change as far as what you can and can't do and stuff.
Because less fishing checks, you know, that was always seemed like more of an issue all the time. You know, I think I got more marijuana arrests than fishing than any other place.
The thing that gets me about the fishing and stuff that I've seen in just the last 5 years is the technology. Now we have live scope and we have all these graphs and stuff. Back in the day, you didn't have all that stuff, so you didn't see the limits of fish being caught. Now, I go to the boat ramp, and we'll check people coming out, and I might check. Everybody may have a limit, where it used to be, you know, just that one or two guys you'd see that, you know, old Joe that had these old B-bottom boat always knew where to go and knew how to catch fish. Now, it's become easy for everybody. I mean, it's just the fish coming out of the lake, I just don't see how it can sustain the source or the pressure, because it's just so many fish being taken out all the time. And it makes it easier and easier because, like, live scope, and nothing against live scope. I went and bought one because it's fun, but I mean, it just makes it so easy now.
And when you speak about a live scope, that's just an underwater camera, correct?
Right.
Okay.
Yep. Kind of like a depth finder. It's a depth finder, but it's really precise, and it can, a fish finder that can, I mean, it, you can watch a fish bite your hook.
So,
it's crazy.
Yeah, and that's an awesome point, how technology is going to affect all populations. I know one thing around the country is the trail cameras now, you know, how that has increased our effectiveness in hunting targeted animals, where before, I mean, to the point where, I think Arizona was the first one to outlaw, you know, trail cameras. And that, to see how the trend goes, because I can see that, and you're actually, you know, there's some things that are being electronic devices as far as hunting. They are restricted in something. You can't use an electronic turkey call. I mean, at least nationwide, I don't think anybody can use an electronic turkey call.
Yeah.
You have to use the manual mouth or hand or something other than that, because think how effective an electronic turkey call would be, and how, and so that's what our biologists have to look at, our population, and how that these new technologies are affecting them. Then we have to regulate appropriately so we can make sure everybody is getting their fair shake recreationally. Certainly commercially, they could wipe out populations if they commercially fish things using some of this technology.
We've found with the live scope, especially on the paddlefish, because you're allowed to fish in Missouri paddlefish during the season. And so we've had guides that are taking out, and they used to, they'd take one group out in the morning, one in the afternoon. And now they're able to take four or five groups out because they have the live scope now, and they can target those fish easily.
Wow.
Now with the live scope. So, and I've heard them talking about maybe a change in some regulations and stuff, but I don't know. That's way above my pay grade as far as what they're decided to do with that. But it's very interesting how that could, just like you were saying, the game cameras. I have had discussions with friends of mine, that a gentleman friend of mine, he sets 15 game cameras out. I'm like, why? He goes, well, I know where that deer's going. Mm. And then I know when it's there, and I know it's going to that next camera. So I go out. He don't even go out and hunt till he sees the deer in the area. And it's just like, that's not hunting.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's definitely changed the way we, the way we hunt, for sure. No, which is, you're right. It's not hunting. It's, and it fits into our busy schedules. I will say that. Because, bear hunting, I get out like once, and I had better intentions of that. But if I knew exactly when that bear was going to be there, of course I'd be there. And that's, it fits into our busy schedules, so to speak. But if we're more effective than we were before, if that's going to certainly affect wildlife populations, that paddlefish example is huge. It's huge, you know, certainly. And you brought up a good point that I always just say, I don't make the laws, I just enforce them. If you don't like the laws, call your representative, call your fish and game commissioner. But these rules are normally set up for a reason. It's usually a biological reason or a social reason. So, and that's what, fish and game laws have been based on forever. More so biological, I think, in the last, 25 years compared to social before, like hunting on Sundays. Does that have a biological effect? Well, you could say it there's less effort if you don't allow Sunday hunting. Then I'm not sure what Missouri does, but I know we have one of our adjoining states doesn't allow Sunday hunting, which helps New Hampshire. Huh. Because they all come to New Hampshire during Sundays if they border. So it increases our sales.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So
I've never heard that before. That's the first time I'd ever heard that there was actually a regulation like that.
Yep. No Sunday hunting. Yeah. Which is interesting. But it has an effect. You say, it was social probably when it started because of church and things like that. But nowadays, I think it's the amount of effort you put in to harvest that amount of deer. So if you add that Sunday hunt, how much are you going to add to your take? And are you going to do that? Because that's how they weigh harvest reports, is how much effort you put in compared to what you've harvested. Yeah, so I find it fascinating as I talk to game wardens around the country and around the world, the little different things. But that's all affecting us, Susan, that technology. And the interesting thing, the paddlefish, where you said, two trips a day, but now they can zoom out, catch their limits, pick up another crew, zoom out. I mean, you're talking four fish a day to 12 fish a day?
Yeah, could be even more than that.
Wow. I mean, but if it's a put and take system, like you said, there's no breeding of paddlefish.
And I could be wrong on that. They may in some of the areas. Mm-hmm. I'm not real sure.
Yeah.
I know I worked at the hatchery, and I come from a trout hatchery background, so I know at the trout hatchery, we stocked and raised trout at Tanny Como Hatchery at Branson, and it was a put and take. The trout didn't reproduce. I mean, there may be a small amount of them that reproduce, but successful reproduction was not possible with the trout there because of the water fluctuating. Now on the lake, it may be different. I may be wrong on that, but
well, those are all things. Again, if it's a put and take fishery where we're raising them for them to be caught. So that's another thing that has to be looked at. So there's all kinds of little aspects to fish and game work that's interesting. And I think sportsmen and women need to understand that. And those are the questions we always get. Is it, well, why'd the state do that? Why'd the state, you know, we're always made to be out the bad guy. And there is reasons. And if I could ask if they can ask a question of, hey, why did they do that? You know, and then come out with an answer.
I think our paddle fish are a lot like our walleye here. We have walleye that reproduce, but they don't reproduce soon enough or fast enough. So we do have hatcheries that stock walleye in so many, not nearly enough, but I do know we do raise some paddlefish in the hatcheries and stock them. But
right. And that's sometimes driven by the expectation of the sportsmen and women out there that are harvesting them. If we stopped stocking things, I mean, the take would go drastically down, and boy, then we'd have an uproar. No, Missouri sounds like a very cool place. The only experience I've had is watching that show, The Ozarks. So I had to bring that up. So, and then I learned the Ozarks just aren't in Missouri. I always thought the Ozarks were just in Missouri, but it's a whole strip, kind of like the Appalachia.
Yeah.
That was something I learned because I didn't realize the Ozarks run right down, and correct me if I'm wrong. Then they grab a little bit of Tennessee, a little bit.
I think so.
A little bit of maybe, I'm gonna stop there because my geographics aren't that good. But it runs like through three states or more. So yeah, it's just like the Appalachian region.
Yeah.
So, and you got the northern end of that, Susan, is that?
I'm in southwest Missouri.
Southwest.
So I'm down kind of border Kansas, Oklahoma.
Okay.
Some of Arkansas. Our region does. So we're down at the very bottom. We're not in the Boot Heel part, but we're in the other side, the southwest.
Mm. Well, looking the view out your window, it looks like a gorgeous, gorgeous place for sure.
Yeah, it's a nice day today. We're supposed to get some storms this afternoon maybe, but.
Yeah. Do you have to deal with tornadoes at all down there?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's, again, something that I'm very unfamiliar with, and I'm pretty happy I'm unfamiliar with it. So,
yeah.
Hey, Susan, thanks so much for joining Warden's Watch and giving us a little piece of Missouri, a little piece of being a game warden female for 34 years, and then switching it up, getting a canine, getting revitalized, for sure. I mean, we certainly talked about, you know, how our job changes, and it's great if you want to change, if you want to transfer out to a different area, that changes. But if you want to get into a specialty team, that changes. And then if you want to get promoted, it changes the whole aspect. And if that's what the next generation is looking for, is change, I think being a game warden, a conservation officer in any state would be a great career.
Absolutely.
Hey, I really appreciate you joining me for the second time.
Yep, that's fine.
Great.
It's like I said, the first time, it's like it's the job is like chocolate cake, and then the canine's like putting the frosting on top of the cake. It's just it's a great job, and it's a great, you know, career. If anybody wants to go into it, it's a lot of fun.
That's just awesome. No, I appreciate you, and that's a good way to end this podcast. So thanks again, Susan Swim from Missouri.
Thank you.